Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, December 3rd, and we're doing digestive system today. And we started it last time, so we're going to kind of start where we left off. Oh, I got to check this recorder. The battery door just opened up. Nope, it's looking good. All right, so I loaded up a bunch of lectures onto the website last night. Maybe yesterday sometime, I'm not sure. So they should be there for you. Let me know if you can't see them. Don't forget the videos that are in Blackboard, different website. All right, so let's look at the schedule on the right-hand side. December 3rd, digestive. We're going to probably get into urinary system today. And then next time on Wednesday, we'll finish urinary system and start diversification. And on Monday will be the last lecture and maybe a review if you guys come with questions. And then a week from this Wednesday is the last exam, okay, covering these chapters right here. And it's not a cumulative exam. It just covers these chapters, and it's going to be exactly like any of the previous tests. Okay, and that's going to be Wednesday. All right, so some people are scheduled to have a lab practicum on Wednesday, December 12th. All right, the Wednesday lab groups, but I'm offering that practicum to them on Monday, after the usual class takes a practicum. So Monday morning, I'll give a practicum for the Wednesday morning class, maybe starting around 9, but I'm not really sure exactly what time that is, because the Monday group has to take two quizzes as well. They got to take quiz number 10 and the extra quiz. The Wednesday group is already going to be done with quizzes by that time. And then the Wednesday afternoon lab, you can take the practicum after the normal Monday-Wednesday lab. So that will be, let's see, 12:30 to 1:30, so somewhere close to 2 o'clock, somewhere in there. Okay, but they have to take two quizzes too before we can start. So if you're confused about that, then talk to me after class or in lab, and I can explain it to you. Okay. All right, so last time we started with a digestive system, and we worked with a concept called surface area. And here's a question that you should be able to answer. In everyday language, what should you call surface area? Not just by the structure, but partly by the function that it's performing. You should think of it as a doorway, right? And we measured the surface area of this door right here, which turned out to be exactly 2 square meters. And then we calculated that the surface area of the small intestine is over 2,000 square feet. Right, so that's a huge surface area for absorption. Okay, that's important. The other thing that we were kind of keeping track of are the amount of fluids that are secreted by the oral cavity, namely the salivary glands. Anybody remember what that was? How much fluid is secreted by salivary glands? You know, here you go, 1.5. So 0.75, so 3/4 of a liter to 1.5 liters of saliva every day. So that fluid is coming out of your body because your mouth is not really inside your body. So that could dehydrate you if you were to lose that water. Plus, you lose even more water because the stomach adds another 1.5 liters of gastric juice to the stomach. So now we're up to 3 liters of fluid that you're losing. Right? That's a whole lot of fluid, but that's not the only place. The stomach, almost 2 liters. All right, so almost 5 liters of fluid you lose and is placed into the digestive tract. So that's a little foreshadowing because we're going to see where you regain that water again so that you don't dehydrate. All right, then we need to talk about some of the microscopic structure. Here's a reason why the surface area of the small intestine is so large, because of all the folds, the gross folds, right, the submicroscopic folds, and even the microscopic folds. So first, think of all these circular folds as being gross folds. You can stretch them out and make the intestines longer. And then each of these villi right here could be stretched out, and that makes the small intestine even larger. And then on top of these cells are microvilli, which increases the surface area even further. So those are the three structures that increase the surface area or the doorway for absorption. Plicae circularis, number 1, villi, number 2, and microvilli, number 3. If you add all that up, over 2,000 square feet for surface area, or 47 by 47, 240 square meters. How big was that doorway? How big was that doorway? We measured it. 1 meter by 2 meters, which equals, you multiply those two numbers together, you get 2 square meters, but the surface area for absorption in your small intestine is what? Is 100 times more. So put 100 of those doors together, and that's what the doorway for absorption is in the small intestine. That's phenomenal. All right. So let's move on to some of the cells of the small intestine. So here we see a villus, and I see a capillary in the very center. Right here, capillaries absorb sugars and amino acids, or small proteins, right? But not lipids. Lipids are absorbed by this lymphatic capillary that goes up into a villus. And does anybody know what this lymphatic capillary is? We talked about it in the lymphatic system. It's called a lacteal, right? So the lacteal is in the very center. That's for absorption of lipids. So these are the absorptive cells that line the villus, and I even see some goblet cells, but in between the villi, we see some intestinal glands. Sometimes we call these the crypts, right? Intestinal crypts, and here's the opening to an intestinal crypt, and they contain other kinds of cells, right? The crypts, also known as intestinal glands, right? And there's, you probably can find some goblet cells in there because they secrete mucus, and that prevents the autodigestion of that epithelium. All right, they secrete mucus, and some of the cells secrete other hormones like secretin and cholecystokinin. We'll talk about what those do in just a second. And enterocytes that secrete digestive juice or intestinal juice with digestive enzymes into the small intestine. Okay, so I want to talk about the function of the different parts of the digestive tract. All right, so your mouth is just there to chomp up big food pieces into small food pieces, add a little lubricant to it so that it slides down into the stomach via what kind of tube? What's the name of that tube? The esophagus, yeah. Then it's in the stomach. What's the function of the stomach? We're talking about the digestive system, but the main function of the stomach is not digestion. Storage and mixing. It has strong muscles so that it mixes up gastric juice with food to produce chyme, okay? A little bit of digestion in terms of pepsin and proteins, but that's about it. But mostly it's for mixing and storing. So remember those key terms. Then we're to the small intestine, right? Here we are at the small intestine. And what's the function of the small intestine? Digestion of nutrients. That's where you absorb most of your nutrients, if not all of the nutrients in your diet. And digestion. So first digestion breaks proteins down into amino acids and complex sugars down into monosaccharides and lipids down into smaller lipids. And then they're absorbed. So the small intestine is for digestion and absorption, much different than the stomach. Okay, when food enters the stomach, okay, secretin, okay, tells the pancreas to start to secrete a fluid, which is high in bicarbonate, which means it's very basic. That will neutralize the stomach acid that's coming from the stomach. Right? Cholecystokinin, the other hormone, right here, signals, it goes in the blood and signals the gallbladder to start contracting. And what does that do? What does that squish into the small intestine? Bile, right? And that's an emulsifier, but it also contains other compounds that can neutralize stomach acid. So that's another important function. Secretin also tells the stomach that the small intestine is busy, and secretin then quiets the stomach down so that it doesn't overload the stomach with chyme. I mean, overload the small intestine with chyme. Other things that we see in the lamina propria, here is some lymphatic tissue. Here's a node of lymphatic tissue that we call MALT, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. And that's to prevent the entry of bacteria that are in the small intestine from getting inside the body. All right, so those are the salient features of the small intestine. All right, let's look at the pancreas. Where's the pancreas at? All right, so the pancreas has a broad part near the small intestine, which we call the head, Okay, and the tail is out over here, way to the left. And the pancreas has both an exocrine and an endocrine function. The pancreas can secrete a hormone that I'm sure everybody is familiar with. It helps adjust blood sugar levels. It's called insulin. Insulin is secreted into the blood, and then it travels everywhere in the body. That's the endocrine part of the pancreas, along with another hormone called glucagon. Glucagon and insulin work opposite each other. And that's a really good thing because that antagonism provides for precise control and balance of blood glucose in your body. Physiology class, we go over this pretty extensively. Right? But what we're talking about here is the exocrine part of the pancreas, where digestive enzymes or precursors to digestive enzymes are released into the small intestine, as well as some fluids that can neutralize stomach acids. Right? And those things are secreted into a duct. So that's the big difference between an exocrine division and the endocrine division. An endocrine division secretes hormones that go directly into the blood. The exocrine division secretes compounds that have to go through the pancreatic duct to get to the small intestine. They don't travel by the blood, and these are digestive enzymes. Trypsin and chymotrypsin for protein digestion. Does anybody remember the name of the enzyme for protein digestion in the stomach? Pepsin is it, right? But it's a little pre-digestion. It's not a complete digestion. That doesn't happen until that food gets into the small intestine. Then pancreatic amylase for, it's very similar to the amylase secreted by salivary glands for digestion of what kind of stuff? That was a question when I go, of? That's how you do in lab. The bile duct? No, not bile duct. It's bile duct. Okay, but so my question is, what is pancreatic amylase for? Digestion of complex sugars, like starch, down into simpler sugars so that they can be absorbed. And then pancreatic lipase. Now, this one is easy because I see an ASE at the end. That means it's an enzyme. And the substrate for this enzyme is the first part of the word. Okay, it can digest lipids, right? So all of these things are secreted by the pancreas into this duct, which carries it into the small intestine. Okay, here's the major duodenal papillae. Okay, there's some sphincters, there's some circular smooth muscles that controls the secretion of digestive enzymes, as well as bile, right, into the small intestine. All right, so that's pretty good for the small intestine. It's the main organ of the digestive system for what two important functions? And the pancreas helps. Bile helps from the liver. It is what? Digestion. Oh, it's in your lecture notes. Digestion as well as absorption of nutrients. Absorption of nutrients. All right, so let's take a look at the large intestine. All right, here's a nice picture of the large intestine. This was a quiz for you, labeling quiz. So you got stomach, which is up over here, and then small intestine is coiled all around here. And I would like for you to tell me the three divisions of the small intestine, from proximal to distal. Proximal meaning next to the stomach. Distal is the part that attaches to the large intestine. So starting proximally, what's the name? Duodenum. You could say duodenum, that's fine. The middle part is jejunum, and then the distal part is called the ileum. And when I say distal, that's the last part, right? That's the very last part. So here is a part of the ileum, and that small intestine, what part of the small intestine is that? Yeah, it's the ileum. But what part of the small intestine is the ileum? How would you talk about it? Because I see it right here. If I see it right here, you guys have to be able to talk about it. Is it the proximal, middle, or distal? Distal, yeah, it's the distal part of the small intestine, right? So here it is, and it's going to empty contents into the large intestine. And remember, what's the function of the small intestine once again? Two things, digestion and absorption. So nutrients should be absorbed, and no nutrients should be emptied into the large intestine, right, from the ileum. So very little nutrients should enter the large intestine via the ileocecal valve. And that's a very strong sphincter. So So that material flows into the large intestine, and here are the parts of the large intestine, but I want you to know what the function of the large intestine is. If digestion and absorption take place in the small intestine, then digestion and absorption of nutrients should not be an important part of the large intestine. But why do we have a large intestine? Why is it there? It's a big structure. Because remember all of those fluids that we secreted into the digestive tract, like saliva, 1 liter or 2 liters, and gastric juice, about 2 liters, and intestinal juice from the small intestine, another 3 liters, right? If you were to lose that fluid, you become dehydrated. So the job of the large intestine right here is to resorb all of that water that was secreted for the purposes of digestion. So that's the main function of the large intestine. The large intestine is inhabited with just billions of bacteria. We call that the normal microbiota of the small intestine. And these bacteria provide helpful nutrients to us, certain kinds of vitamins. Right? So there should be bacterial fauna in the large intestine, but they should not leave the large intestine and then move into your body. Okay, so there are glands, mucosa-associated lymphatic nodules that protect and maintain the proper kinds of bacteria in the large intestine. All right, so here we have the cecum, which accepts the digested material from the small intestine. Our cecum is not very big, and here's a little vestigial part of a cecum, and it's called a vermiform appendix. It's not used for anything in us except for it contains a lot of malt. So it's important for immune response. Right? So it has a lot of lymphatic tissue. And then we have the ascending colon, the transverse colon, descending colon. This little squiggly part here is the sigmoid colon, then the rectum and anal canal, and here I see the external anal sphincter. All right, so the job of the large intestine, we said, was to absorb water that was secreted into the digestive tract. And when that material has water removed from it, what does it produce? What's left over? Feces. So another way of talking about the function of the large intestine is to produce feces, but you should understand exactly what that means. It means absorbing water and some salts from the chyme that's coming from the ileum right here. Okay, these little pockets are what we call a haustra. So here's a haustrum, here's a haustrum, here's a haustrum. These three little pockets right here are called haustra. Haustra is plural for haustrum. Here's a little insertion, here's a ligament for insertion of smooth muscles. Okay, and we call that the tinea coli. That should be mentioned on here someplace. Where's tinea coli? On the other side? Tinea coli. Right here. There are little pockets of adipose that hang from the tinea coli. We call these epiploic appendages. And if you ever find out why they are there, I would really like to know. If you could find out the reason for these epiploic appendages. I don't know if anybody knows just yet. And here is a nice 90-degree bend. Sometimes we call that a ramus, but in the intestinal tract, we call that a flexure. Okay, and I see another flexure over here. All right, so what kind of flexure is over here, and what organ is it next to? So you're looking at some large intestine or large bowel, like you're looking at mine. Okay, so you're looking at mine. Here it is over here. Which one is that? That's the right colic flexure. And you have a big organ in the abdominal cavity on your right side, which is the liver, right? So sometimes it's called the hepatic flexure. So anytime you hear that term hepato or hepatic, you should just automatically think of liver, right? Okay, and then on the other side, stomach is right here, and there's another organ that kind of slides right underneath the greater curvature of the stomach. That is the spleen. You've seen that when you've done your dissection. So this is called the splenic flexure, or you could call it the left colic flexure because it's on the left-hand side. Okay. So this is the colon. I forget how many people die of colon cancer in the United States. I think it's about 20,000 people. It's just in the United States. That's a pretty serious disease. But colon cancer, there can be tumors that develop in the sigmoid colon and the descending colon, and then those cells break away from the intestine and maybe move to the liver and start growing in the liver, and it destroys the liver. Or maybe some of those cells break away and go to the brain and destroy the brain, or to the bone and destroys bone. or other kinds of tissue. So cancer certainly is a very deadly kind of process. And that's really unfortunate that so many people die of colon cancer because it's easily detected. And if it's caught early, then it's completely curable. So those 20,000 people really don't need to die, right? And the way that it is detected early is by inserting optical tubes and cameras into the large intestine, right? And a physician or maybe a technologist can take a look around and see if there are tumors or things poking into the lumen of the large intestine. We call those polyps, right? And a polyp is a benign tissue usually. They're removed because maybe in 10 years they can turn into cancer, so they're removed at that time. All right, so that's called a colonoscopy, when a camera is inserted all the way up here to the left colic flexure. Sometimes a more minor procedure is used that just looks at the sigmoid colon. We call that a sigmoidoscopy. Okay, and the only difficult thing, and usually that's done under anesthesia, some form of anesthesia, it's not too difficult the procedure, but there is something difficult about it. It's the night before. All right, it's not during the procedure, because if you want a nice look around inside the large intestine, there shouldn't be anything in the large intestine to obscure your view. All right, so the large intestine has to be cleaned out. And sometimes diuretics are given anally, sometimes diuretics are given orally, and I think that's really the preferred method by most physicians. All right, you have to drink a solution that's called Go Lightly, okay? And that's really a misnomer, because that's the last thing you're going to do is go lightly, okay? You're going to go very heavily. That lightly stands for electrolyte solution, so it has mineral, it has sodium and potassium, so it doesn't wreck your electrical balance or ion balance inside your body. Okay, and of course, you know, you might be up all night doing that, but you have to have an extremely clean colon so that you have a good exam. Now, which exam would you like to have? Just a sigmoidoscopy or a colonoscopy? Okay. Well, a lot of times somebody gets a sigmoidoscopy and they notice some polyps and they say, guess what? We have to reschedule this exam. We need to do a colonoscopy. We need to look at this descending colon right here. So what do you have to do a second time? Preparation. You got to come back. You got to prepare yourself again, which was what? Staying up all night, going lightly. Okay, which is what I said, a misnomer. All right, so I suggest just getting a colonoscopy. Forget this sigmoidoscopy right here, because a lot of times you have to repeat the exam. So be, okay, forceful with your physician and say, I don't want a sigmoidoscopy, I want a colonoscopy, and just get it all done at the same time. Probably you don't have to do that until age 40 or 45, maybe 50, depending on how they rearrange the guidelines, unless you have a family history of colon cancer. Then I think it starts at an earlier age, like 40. Okay. All right, so what did we say? Who's living in this large intestine here? Who's living in there? Bacteria. Billions of bacteria. All right, and they kind of survive, but they don't get many nutrients from the material coming from the small intestine, right? Because what's the job of the small intestine? Absorption, right? So it absorbs nutrients. But if for whatever reason nutrients enter the large intestine, for instance, people, as we get older, lose an enzyme called lactase, which is an enzyme that breaks down lactose. Lactose is the sugar. And you know what kind of food lactose is in? Lactose, the sugar? It's in dairy products, like milk, ice cream, right? Cheeses maybe to some degree. All right, so some of our favorite foods contain lactose, and when somebody gets old enough, they can't metabolize that lactose because they're not producing lactase, so that lactose enters the small intestine. And who's waiting there to have a really big party? All these bacteria. They say, thank you very much for all of that lactose, and guess what they do? They start to proliferate, okay? And it irritates the large intestine, increases motility of the large intestine, and that produces copious amounts of watery stool, otherwise known as diarrhea. Okay? So the job of the large intestine is not to absorb nutrients, because those bacteria are going to get to it first. What's the job of the large intestine? Absorbing water that was secreted into the digestive tract. But if you mess with that system, and make the small intestine very irritable, then that water does not get resorbed, right? It comes out the anal canal. And then what could happen to your body as a result? Dehydration. That's right. And more people in this world die of dehydration due to diarrhea than any other cause. Okay? And that's due to drinking contaminated water, which is very rare in the United States, but it's extremely common throughout the rest of the world. So that's sort of interesting. If you want to save more lives than anybody else, what could you do for people? Figure out ways that they can have clean drinking water. That's just amazing. And it's usually neonates, right, and very young people that die, that are very susceptible to dying of diarrhea. But it could happen to anybody, including you. All right, so there was a drug called Xenical. Xenical was a drug that blocked absorption of lipids from the small intestine. Right, and if you don't absorb lipids, then your calorie intake goes way down, and it was designed to be a drug to help people that wanted to lose weight. Because lipids have a lot of energy, and if you don't have lipids in your diet, you will probably lose weight. Or if you just take this pill and you can't absorb lipids, you'll lose weight too, because those lipids don't get into your body. All right, but where do those lipids go if they're not absorbed by the small intestine? If they're not absorbed by the small intestine, where do they end up? They end up in the large intestine. And who's there with a bunch of smiley faces? All those bacteria, right? And so they say, thanks for all that energy, all those lipids, and it irritates the large intestine, produces copious amounts of watery stool, which we call diarrhea. So taking that little pill, all right, but it's not just water, it's also oily. And people that take Xenical can't even tell when they're stooling themselves. So what do you have to wear when you're taking that drug? Yeah, you got to wear diapers. Well, you know what? It was not a very popular drug once people started to use it. You probably can get a prescription for it still, but it's not very nice because you could be driving down the 405 freeway and then you got to change your diaper, okay? So the point I'm trying to make is, what's the function of the small intestine here? Absorption of nutrients, right? And the large intestine is absorption of water, okay? And if the large intestine can't do that, then you have a problem, okay? So in a lot of medications, it might say it produces diarrhea, okay? And now you have a pretty good sense of why some medication might produce diarrhea, because it blocks absorption of some kind of nutrient in the small intestine, and that produces that diarrhea, unfortunately. And when the small intestine gets irritated like that, and the large intestine gets irritated, we call that a malabsorption syndrome. So any kind of malabsorption syndrome is going to produce diarrhea. And if not treated or left to go, it could produce death as well. Okay, large intestine, anal canal, the internal anal sphincter, which I can't really see right here, is under autonomic control. Okay, so your autonomic nervous system causes it to relax. And then that presses on the external anal sphincter. Somebody has an urgency, all right, for a bowel movement. And then, of course, you are in control of your external, because that is what? That's a skeletal muscle. So you relax that consciously under proper times, in most cases, in healthy people. All right, so that's large intestine. Oh, I would like to say something else about the digestive tract. You know, when you become a nurse or a PA or whatever track you're taking, you'll have to take classes or seminars throughout your whole life to keep your certification up going, their continuing medical education hours. All right, I know you're looking forward to more anatomy after you get a good job, but it will be fun. But especially go to hear physicians that are gastroenterologists that deal with the digestive tract. And I have found that these people have the best sense of humor of anybody, because what are they talking about all the time? They talk about diarrhea and gas and malabsorption syndrome and all kinds of things that normally you don't speak about. And they're really fascinating lectures and interesting people, as opposed to go and listen to a neurosurgeon. That's really boring to listen to a neurosurgeon. Okay, but I hope nobody in here ever needs a neurosurgeon. Okay. Go listen to gastroenterologists. Okay, and some of the vitamins that those bacteria produce, I forgot, is vitamin K. Vitamin K is anybody know what vitamin K is necessary for? Blood clotting function. So without vitamin K, you'll have a tendency to bleed. Probably not bleed to death, but it's, I suppose, possible. All right, so that produces a precursor to vitamin K. And what kind of, and you have to have this in your diet. You can't make it. These bacteria help you make it. From what kind of food sources? Does anybody know? Green leafy vegetables are it. And probably one of the best ones, it doesn't look so leafy, and that is broccoli. Broccoli is really good, right? It's not all absorbed by the small intestine, feeds these bacteria, and it produces vitamin K for you. Now, who does not like broccoli? Does anybody not like broccoli in here? Everybody does. That's great. I had some nephews that hated broccoli when they were growing up, when they were 4 or 5 years old, would never eat broccoli. And my nephews, and they're guys, right? And guys are pretty rough when they're playing, and somebody would eventually end up in the coffee table with their nose, and then they get a nosebleed, okay? And we couldn't stop the nosebleed because they didn't have vitamin K in their body, you know, unless we sat them still and pinched their nose together. So I would sit them down and I would talk about the Hoekstra right here, malabsorption syndrome, and how important vitamin K was for blood clotting function. We go over blood clotting function and vitamin K, and I said, where you get vitamin K is from broccoli. And guess what? They would never eat broccoli. My nephews would rather die from bleeding from hemorrhage than eat broccoli. Okay, that's sort of interesting. So if you have birds at home that have a bleeding disorder, what should you feed them? Broccoli. Okay, because it provides that nice vitamin K for them. Okay, the liver. Let's look at the liver. Those are some interesting stories about the digestive system. Liver we looked at in lab quite extensively. All right, here's the liver, right lobe, left lobe. Gallbladder is tucked away underneath it. And then the caudate is back over here. The quadrate is posterior but underneath the liver. Oh, so you can see these things. So here's the quadrate lobe, and posteriorly is the caudate lobe. So there are four main lobes. And, of course, you need to know the bile duct system. And you should be able to draw that in your sleep, right? And remember, the liver produces bile, which is necessary for the emulsification of lipids so that lipids can be digested. And the right lobe and left lobe produce bile constantly, but you're not eating constantly, so that doesn't need to end up in the small intestine day and night. So it's secreted by the right hepatic and left hepatic duct, right, which then join together to form the common hepatic duct right here. When you're in a fasted state, bile goes into the cystic duct, into the gallbladder. When you're in a fed state, the small intestine releases cholecystokinin, which causes this gallbladder to start squishing, contracting. That squishes bile back out the cystic duct into the bile duct. Remember that bile duct goes through the pancreas, joins with the main pancreatic duct, and then through the major duodenal papillae into the duodenum, into the small intestine, for it to do its job. So that's pretty important. And here was a figure that's still pretty good. This is a much better figure than what they used to have in the book. Okay, so liver neutralizes acids, emulsifies fats for digestion, like we said, and it neutralizes acids because the material coming from the stomach is highly acidic. And that duodenal papillae is right in what segment of the small intestine? The duodenal papillae, which is the entrance of the bile duct into the small intestine. What part of the small intestine is that? That's right. And that's why it's named duodenal papillae, right? Which is the proximal division, and that's right by the stomach. So that helps neutralize stomach acids. All right, so make sure you know that bile duct anatomy. This, I'm sure, is an exam figure. All right, so the liver can store a number of things, and one of the most important things is sugar. One form of sugar that plants like to store is starch. And where can you find starch in a plant? The roots, like a potato, almost pure starch, okay? And the building block of starch is glucose, which is a simple sugar. In animals, however, we don't store glucose in the form of starch. We store it in the form of glycogen. So glycogen really is glucose that's stored in the liver, and it can be broken down when you're in a fasted state. That glucose can be then put into the blood, and that maintains blood glucose levels so that you don't become hypoglycemic. All right, vitamins are stored in the liver, like A, B12, D, E, and K. These are fat-soluble vitamins, as well as some minerals like copper and iron. What do you think copper is good? I mean, what do you think iron is good for? Yeah, red blood cells, making red blood cells. And copper is necessary for some, you don't have to know. Okay. Okay, the liver can convert things, can convert an inactive vitamin D into an active form of vitamin D. And vitamin D is necessary for absorption of calcium from your digestive tract. So it helps in absorption. It can convert fats to phospholipids. Have you ever run into a phospholipid in this class? What's a phospholipid good for? What does it make? All cell membranes are made out of phospholipids. Okay, and it converts amino acids to sugar, and it can convert proteins into sugar and fat. But what the liver can't do, oh here, an ammonia to urea. Ammonia is a byproduct of amino acid or protein metabolism. It's very, very toxic. Our bodies can't get rid of it, but the liver converts ammonia to urea, and then your kidneys can get rid of urea, which is another way of getting rid of ammonia that's in your body, which is a nitrogen-containing compound. And the liver produces a lot of clotting factors so that you have normal blood clotting function. Okay, one thing to notice right here, we see that amino acids can be converted into sugar. Proteins and sugar can be converted into fat. These are the basic three food groups. We have proteins, sugars, and fat in our diet. We also have some nucleic acids, but that's a pretty minor component. So protein and sugar can be converted into fat, but guess what? Fat cannot be converted into sugar. Fat cannot be converted into protein. So anytime you eat a fat, what's its fate? It can only be fat, unless it's metabolized for energy. Okay? So that's just something funny about our bodies. Okay? You can't use fat to make sugars or proteins. It's always fat. And there's an interesting molecule that's in adult beverage, which is ethanol. And guess what kind of molecule it's close to? Is ethanol close to protein, sugar, or fat? There's no way that you would really know this, except maybe you would. Ethanol, alcohol, is very similar to fat. So when you drink ethanol, what's it like eating? A bar of butter. Okay, it's highly caloric. And it converts this liver right here into a fatty liver, because then that alcohol, once converted to fat in the liver, can turn into a fatty liver. And after a fatty liver, what happens? Liver cirrhosis, and then you no longer have a liver, and you need a liver transplant. So I think I've known some people to drink themselves to death just by drinking 6 beers every night. Okay, day in and day out, that's enough in some people to cause a... I know that's not very much, huh? Because you're drinking 2 6-packs a night? Ay, ay, ay. Hopefully after you study anatomy. Okay, so guess what? Oh, that's it for the digestive system. Okay, who's got some questions on the digestive system? Make sure you know the functions of each of those divisions, like the small intestine. Oh, I got one more comment. All right, so we saw the digestive system load a bunch of water into the digestive tract and then goes all the way through the intestine. Things are absorbed. And then in the large intestine, what happens to that water? It's removed from the material before elimination. That reminds me of a machine that you have in your house, an appliance. It reminds me of an appliance. Okay, so what kind of appliance does that remind you of? It's a little bit different, but the analogy is imperfect, but it's a pretty good analogy anyway. Okay, it reminds me of the washing machine. That's right, because you put a bunch of dirty clothes in the washing machine, and what does the washing machine do? It adds some bile, namely detergents, right, or you do, and then it adds water, right, and washes all the clothes, and then before you take your clothes out, what does it do with all that water? It throws it out of the washing machine. So it reminds me of the digestive tract. Okay, it functions just a little bit different, but nonetheless, I like it. All right, so that's digestive tract. So we're doing good. We're doing good. So here is digestive tract. As a matter of fact, maybe I'll just close this down. Unless somebody has some questions about the digestive tract. Save changes? Sure. Okay, urinary system. And let me go find urinary system pictures. And what chapter is urinary system? Looks like 24. Okay, so here are a bunch of pictures. The nice thing about the urinary system is that it's a fairly simple system. It only has four organs that you have to know about. Right there, the kidneys, ureters, urinary bladder, and urethra. We see them all on this slide right here. Maybe the next one is even better. Yeah, that's even better. Okay, so the kidneys are very close to the abdominal cavity, right? Because here is the diaphragm. But they're not in the peritoneal cavity. They're not in the abdominal cavity. They're behind the peritoneum. So we call them retroperitoneal. They're embedded in muscles of the back and some perirenal fat. And you know what? Anytime you hear that term renal, what should you be thinking of? Not the liver, right? Not bone, okay, but kidneys. Yeah, you're exactly right. Okay, so perirenal fat acts as a little shock absorber for these kidneys so they don't get beat up too much. All right, so here is a kidney. Right on top is the adrenal gland. That's not an important part of the digestive tract. That's more of an endocrine organ. Right, so the job of the kidney is manifold, but one of the primary functions is to produce urine. Okay, and then that urine that the kidney produces flows into this little tube, right, and this is what we call a ureter, which then goes down to the urinary bladder. The kidneys have to produce urine 24 hours a day. If they stop producing urine, then they die, and then you need a kidney transplant, okay, or you need to be on dialysis all the time. So the kidneys are producing urine all the time, but you're not voiding urine all the time under most circumstances, right? If you're a healthy individual, it's stored in the urinary bladder, right? Because what kind of epithelium is in the urinary bladder? Transitional. So it can stretch, right? And then after voiding, it goes down. It stretches and then returns to its original shape. And the way that the bladder is voided is through another tube called the urethra. And just like the large intestine, there is an internal urethral sphincter and an external, right? And the external is under voluntary control so that you void at a proper time. Okay, so those are the main structures. So let's take a nice view of the, maybe I want to talk about some of the functions a little bit. Okay, these probably you should memorize. Okay, it removes waste products from the blood. Like we mentioned one just previously. I don't know if you can remember it because you didn't have a chance to look it over once again. Okay, but it's a breakdown product of protein metabolism or amino acids, and that is urea. Okay, so it can excrete urea. Kidneys are really good for that. It helps control blood volume, how much blood you have in your circulatory system, and think of that as air inside your tire. Okay, well, maybe when you go out to your car today, you might see that your tire is sort of flat, right? So you drive to the gas station and you notice that the pressure inside your tire is real low. So what are you going to do? You're going to do something with air. What are you going to do with your tire that's low on pressure? You're going to hook it up to an air nozzle, and that air nozzle is going to do what? Take air out or put more air in? It puts more air in. Then what happens to the pressure inside the tire when you put air in? It increases, right? All right, so that's what you do when you have a tire low on pressure, and that's what your body does too. When your blood pressure is low, guess what the kidney does? It takes water that will end up in urine and puts it back in your body. So it's putting fluids into your body, and what does that do to your blood pressure? It increases or maintains your blood pressure. So the kidney is real important because it controls blood volume, which also controls blood pressure. Just the volume of blood will keep blood pressure at normal levels or high. It regulates electrolyte levels. Anybody know what an electrolyte is? Could somebody give me an example of an electrolyte? That first part of the word is real important. Electro, electricity. Okay, yeah, these things can conduct electricity. Regulates electrolyte. So what about your body is electrical? Yeah, it's ions like sodium and potassium, calcium ions, chloride ions. All right, so the kidney helps regulate these people because you are a very electrical being. That's how muscles contract, how the heart contracts, how nerves work by working with those different ions. Kidney also regulates pH. Anybody know what pH stands for? Or what's it a measure of? It's a measure of something. Acidity in your body, how basic or acid you are. So the kidney helps regulate that. And then here's a kind of a strange one. It controls red blood cell production. Is that kind of an important process? How many red blood cells in your body die every second? Yeah, it could be as many as 2 million, right? So the kidneys help regulate that level. Okay, so now we're ready to look at some anatomy. We see that the kidney is bean-shaped, for sure. It's about as big as your fist, right? So if you make a fist, that's about as big as your kidney is. I talked about where it's located. On the outside of the kidney, there's some tough connective tissue that we call the renal capsule. Okay, and then it's surrounded by fat. Oh, maybe in the next slide. Oh, here, nice. So here's a kidney, here's a transverse section, here is some of the perirenal fat. All right, here's the abdominal cavity. Remember, abdominal and pelvic cavity joined together to make the peritoneal cavity. So sometimes we call this the peritoneal serous membrane, and the kidneys are not in that cavity. They're behind it, so that's why we call them retroperitoneal. All right, gross anatomy of the kidney. Let's look at some kidneys. Ah, here's a good shot. Nice illustration. I'm sure this is an exam figure. Okay, so here is the renal capsule. And the kidney, like many organs, is not uniform as you go from a superficial region to a deep region. All right, and what do we call the superficial region of an organ? The cortex, and the deep region is what we call the medulla. And the kidney is the same thing. So here is the renal cortex. I don't see a whole lot of structure there, but it has some important structures, right? And then here is the medulla. Let's talk about some of these structures that we see in the medulla. What does this thing here remind you of? In one dimension a triangle, in three dimensions a pyramid, right? So this is what we call the renal pyramid. And in between the renal pyramid, we have renal columns. So here's a pyramid, and then here is a column. Here is a pyramid, here is a column. Good. Okay. And the renal pyramids produce urine and secrete them into this collecting basin at the tip of a renal pyramid. This tip sometimes is called a papillae, right? Like papillary muscle, kind of looks like the tip of your finger. And urine is being secreted from that papillae all the time. It's collected here. This collecting basin is called a calyx, and it's a small one if it's just getting urine from one pyramid, so we call that a minor calyx. So I see a minor calyx here, I see a minor calyx here, I see one here, and I see one here. Now the minor calyces join together. We call that anastomose. And when minor calyces anastomose to make another calyx, which is bigger, we call that the greater calyx or major calyx. So here's the major calyx. And what's in all these calyces? Urine. Okay, and then that urine goes through this funnel-shaped object right here. That's called the pelvis, renal pelvis, and then that pelvis sort of acts like a funnel, funnels urine into the ureter, and where does it go after that? Urinary bladder, okay? So those are some of the structures, okay? But not everything, okay? I see a renal artery and a renal vein. What organ does a renal artery go to? Renal artery, where does it go? Kidney, because anytime you hear that term renal, you should think of what? Kidney. Here's the renal vein coming out, and here is a ureter coming out just at this one location in the kidney. There's also a renal nerve that goes in right here. This is the connecting point of the kidney to the rest of the body, and we call that the hilum or the hilus of the kidney, this connecting point, right? It's just an opening that all these structures pass through. Okay, so that's everything on this diagram. Do I have renal sinus? Oh yeah, I have renal sinus. It's not on this illustration anymore. But deep inside the kidney, there are spaces, there are holes between the calyces and between the arteries and veins inside the kidney, and those spaces don't go to waste. They hold something. What does it look like they're holding in this area? Yeah, adipose tissue. So the renal sinuses are filled with adipose tissue. I see here and here. This is just the space deep inside the kidney that is not occupied by a calyx. That's what the sinus is, as opposed to a calyx. All right, here is something pretty important. Click, click, click. Okay, let's look at the vascular supply. Let's see if I have vascular supply, blood flow. major blood vessels. All right, I'm going to cover this topic right now, major blood vessels in the kidney, and then we're going to go back to this topic. All right, so red signifies, remember the kidney is part of the systemic circulation, so red represents what kind of vessel? An artery, right? High in oxygen, and this blue blood vessel right here is a, because it's systemic circulation, that's a vein, relatively low in oxygen. So here is one blood vessel entering, bringing oxygenated blood to the kidney, that is the renal artery. And then it bifurcates once it goes through the hilum, and after the first bifurcation, we call these segmental arteries. So you got renal arteries, segmental arteries. Segmental arteries then bring blood up into a column, right? And the columns are between the pyramids, and sometimes people call these pyramids lobes of the kidney. So sometimes a pyramid and a lobe are used interchangeably. So these are the interlobar arteries, arteries between the pyramids, right? And that's just a continuation of segmental arteries. And then this interlobar artery goes to the base of a pyramid, and it curves over the base. So here's the pyramid, and here's the base of it. And so it kind of forms an arch, right? Forms an arch here, and an arch here, and an arch right over there. So we call these the arcuate arteries at the base of a renal pyramid, okay? And then there are some more arteries that poke up into the cortex, kind of like sun rays coming from the sun. So, and since they're in the cortex, we call these the cortical radiate arteries, cortical radiate. All right, so what do you got? Renal, segmental, interlobar, cortical radiate. Those are the main vessels. And then the veins, bringing blood back to the heart, have the same nomenclature. So you got cortical radiate veins, interlobar veins, segmental veins, and finally, renal vein. Okay, and I think that's what we have right here, except for what's in this dotted line, this box right here, which is what we're going to talk about next. Okay, and so what we're going to talk about next, I have to ask you some questions first so I can get my thoughts together. Okay, what's the structural and functional unit of life? The cell. So if you know all the little components inside a cell, put them all together, then you pretty much know how every cell, how life works, right? So that's handy. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells called? A synapse, right? It's got a bunch of little pieces, right? Vesicles and the presynaptic membrane, synaptic. And if you know all that stuff, how it's put together, if you know one synapse, guess what? You know how all the chemical synapses basically work. Okay. What's another structural and functional unit that we studied, which is really handy? It's a special unit, and if you understand all the pieces of that little unit, you know about how the whole big organ works. Okay. How about a sarcomere? Sarcomere is a structural and functional unit of what? What is a sarcomere specialized to do? Contract, right? So if you know the filaments, the myosin and actin, and how they slide over each other, and the Z-discs and all that kind of stuff, you pretty much know how every muscle works. All right, so in the kidney, the kidney doesn't contract, okay? It doesn't think, it doesn't need synapses, okay? It's not made out of bone, so it doesn't need osteons, all right? But it produces urine. So we want to know the structural and functional unit of urine formation, urine production. And that thing is called the... What do I have over here? The nephron. So we want to learn all the little pieces of a nephron, put it together, and if we understand how one nephron works by knowing all of its pieces, then guess what? We know how all the nephrons work, pretty much, inside your body. Okay, so here are some components of a nephron. There are two main components. There are tubular elements, number one, and number two are vascular elements. They're fluids that move through these tubes and vessels. And you could probably tell me the name of the fluid that moves through vascular elements. What moves through a vascular element? What kind of fluid? It's a connective tissue. I'll give you a hint. It's what? It's blood. So blood is being carried through the vascular elements of a nephron. Okay? But let's go back to these tubular elements. You don't have blood in a tubular element unless the nephron is damaged or if it's infected. If it's infected, then the nephron is damaged. And you can get blood in a tubular element. And you got to know the name of the fluid that's in a tubular element of a kidney, or a tubular element of a nephron. It's called filtrate. And then it goes through the nephron and it comes out urine. So these are the two possible kinds of fluids. And you should never have blood in the urine, right? Unless something is infected or something really bad going on, like maybe a renal tumor or something like that, or nephron disease. All right, so let's look at the elements, the tubular elements first. And just like mitosis, each of these are in a correct order. So you have to know the names of these things, but also the correct order. Here they are. Okay, the first one is Bowman's capsule. This is for filtration. This is where there's a capillary inside Bowman's capsule. It's very leaky. Plasma leaks out into Bowman's capsule, and it leaks out because only small molecules can move across that membrane, and we call that filtration. Just like when you made coffee this morning, all the big chunky stuff stayed back behind the filter, and you had all the little small particles in that fluid that you drank. Unless you had some really fine Turkish coffee, then what? All the big particles are in there still, right? And just can't go wild when you're drinking it. Okay, so in Bowman's capsule, since filtration is the process that produces that fluid, we call that fluid filtrate. So filtrate is in Bowman's capsule. Okay, then that filtrate is going to move into a tube that's connected to Bowman's capsule, and that tube has a lot of twists and turns in it. What do we call something that has lots of twists and turns? Convoluted. Okay? And so since this is close to Bowman's capsule, we call that the proximal convoluted tubule. And these things are in the cortex of the kidney. But something special has to happen. That filtrate has to be transported down into the medulla and then back up into the cortex. And it forms a loop. We call it a loop of Henle that helps concentrate urine. So there's a descending loop and then an ascending loop of Henle. And then filtrate flows into another tube that has a bunch of twists and turns in it. Yeah, and since it's far away from Bowman's capsule, okay, that's called a convoluted tubule, but it's the one that's far away from Bowman's capsule, so it's called a distal convoluted tubule. And then that filtrate is pumped into a collecting duct, okay, and that collecting duct contains urine. So the nephron has processed that filtrate in all of these different tubes right here. Okay, so let's take a look at a nephron. So here. Not too bad. Your book doesn't have really good pictures of a nephron. Let me look at everything. Where is a nephron? So in lab, we get to look at this very nicely. Oh, here's one. Okay. So here are the arcuate arteries and veins. Okay, and this looks really complicated. And this is not an exam figure because it's just too complicated. Once you see what's going on here, it's not too bad. But in your exam figures, in your study guide, I've given you a very straightforward nephron to be able to label. Okay, it's one that I animated, and you can do the animation in Blackboard. It's got some hover exercise, not quite drag and drop. All right, but anyway, let's get back. Here is the arcuate artery. Remember, these are the ones that travel over the base of the pyramids. Here's the arcuate vein. And then here's the cortical radiate artery going up into the cortex, because this is the junction between the cortex and the medulla, which is down over here. Okay, and here we see blood moving in to the nephron. It's going to go through the various vascular elements, and then it's going to be returned to the cortical radiate vein. And then these are all the tubular elements. So here are some twisty and a bunch of tubes that have turns in them. Which kind of tubes are these? Convoluted. And this diagram is so tough, it's hard to tell proximal and distal convoluted tubule. All right, but they're all in there. And then here is a tube that goes down into the cortex and comes back up. This one is easy to see. That's a loop, right? A loop of Henle. And then one is going to be the descending loop and one's going to be the ascending loop. We'll find out how to tell that. Then it goes into the distal convoluted tubule. And then here is a collecting duct, okay, and that takes urine to the tip of a renal papillae. All right, so what do I want you to know about the nephron? This is what I want you to know. Okay, it's got two elements. We mentioned the elements. Look at your lecture notes. What are the two kinds of elements? Tubular elements that contain filtrate and vascular elements that contain blood. Okay, let's start with the tubular elements first. And I'm going to draw them in blue. Hopefully there's a nice marker right here. What's the first part? Oh, it's not very dark, but hopefully you can see that. I don't know if this is blue or not. Let's try it. Does that look blue to you? Not any darker. Let's try one more. Blue. It's even worse. Okay, I'll use this one. Okay, so here's a capsule right here. What's the first tubular element? Bowman's capsule. So I'm going to label this BC for Bowman's capsule. That collects the plasma that's leaking out of a capillary inside of it. And that plasma that leaks out is called filtrate, because it's the process that makes it is called filtration. The first tube next to Bowman's capsule is called, and that you have it on your list, that is the proximal convoluted tubule. And then after that, it goes down into the medulla and it comes back up. So here is the descending loop of Henle, and here is the ascending loop of Henle. Got a little sloppy with that A right there, but you can see that's an A. All right, what's the next tube? Distal convoluted tubule, like this. Okay, and then that goes into a collecting duct. So here's the collecting duct. Here's the distal convoluted tubule. All right, so it's not too bad. You should be able to draw that. And in lab, we will draw it a couple of times. So this is the structural and functional unit that makes urine. What do we call that? We got to title this diagram. Nephron. All right, so here's nephron. And you know that it produces urine. All right, but we're missing something. So here we have filtrate, over here we have urine, but we're missing something from the nephron. What are we missing? Vascular elements. What's the first vascular element? Ooh, nice dark red. It comes in here. Afferent arteriole. I'm just abbreviating, of course, but you have the list already in your notes. And what's the job of an arteriole? What does it do? It takes blood to what kind of structure? It takes blood to everywhere in your body, lungs included. An arteriole is a tiny, tiny artery that takes blood to a capillary. Okay? So after this arteriole, what's got to be right here? A capillary. And it's a very leaky capillary, and it looks like a meatball right in there. The name of this capillary is the glomerulus. That's a very leaky capillary. So plasma leaks out into Bowman's capsule, and then what do we call that fluid in Bowman's capsule? Filtrate. Okay. So I'm just going to put a G right here for glomerulus. That's in there. So this whole structure has got two things. It's got Bowman's capsule and glomerulus on the inside of it. All right. Then blood. Not all the blood gets lost into the filtrate, so some of the blood comes out like this. So what do we say, what do we call a nerve that leaves the central nervous system? Efferent. So here is another, so here's afferent going in, that's like sensory. Here's one going out. So here is efferent. And this blood vessel is going to take blood to another capillary someplace. So this is kind of an interesting circulation. We call it a portal system, where there are two capillary beds back to back. All right, so what do we call a vessel that takes blood to a capillary? Arteriole. So here is the efferent arteriole. It takes blood to a capillary, and here is the last thing that we got to know. Here is a capillary that forms a network over all of these tubes right here. It surrounds the tubes. So what kind of capillary can we call this? Peritubular capillaries, right? So PC, peritubular capillaries. And then here's a little vein collecting blood, right? And so this is a venule right there. All right, so that's the structural and functional unit of urine formation. If you look at this slide right here, it's exactly the same picture, but it's just very artistic, a little too artistic for me. Okay, this is better. All right, so I see peritubular capillaries. I see actually two kinds of nephrons. I see one that has a loop of Henle that just barely goes down into the medulla. This is what we call a cortical nephron. This one right here that has a loop of Henle that goes really, really deep into the medulla. This is what we call a juxtamedullary nephron. They have different jobs. Right, the juxtamedullary nephron. Oh, that clock is wrong. I always forget. This is a special one for making concentrated urine when you start to dehydrate. So this kind of nephron produces very small amounts of urine that are very salty. This nephron over here produces a lot of urine that's very watery. Okay, and that then you can excrete salt. All right, so I got to stop. Sign and sheet is going around. And what do we got to talk about next time? Some good stuff. Okay, some more things about how the nephron works. But at least know the structural components of that nephron right there.